Hello, this is Peter Hill Explains, out on a cardiac walk. I'm standing under a dim street light at the moment and looking at the HSC syllabus space part of it's probably fourth term in HSC, the final year, and there's a series of things that they ask you to do, and I thought I'd just give a general talk about it. Investigate the processes that led to the transformation of radiation into matter that followed the Big Bang, and investigate the evidence that led to the discovery of the expansion of the universe by Hubble. So that's it's what evidence did Hubble use? Forget everything else that we've done. And look, I might actually talk a bit about string theory, which is, you know, like this is, it's quite interesting. Interesting stuff. So I have to, I'm out here to actually rehabilitate and walk. I have to walk for, well, I don't know, 45 minutes a day at least, or more if I'm trying to get there. So this is Peter Hill Explains, as I said before, and it's more a conversation. So 13.8 billion years ago, the universe began as a Planck scale singularity. That's what the belief is. And within a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second, it expanded faster than the speed of light to from something which is smaller than a proton, okay, an electron's much bigger, electron's a nice big juicy thing, expanded to that to the size of a pea. And at that time, there was various symmetry breakings, and pretty well a minute or two after that, the universe is definitely pretty much, the laws of physics are pretty much as we know it. So in that small time, at these scales, a lot of the laws of physics went there. So we experience basically a four-dimensional hologram of X, Y, Z, three dimensions, and time going forward, and we have all frames of reference. You can't tell how fast you're going. If there are two people who are not accelerating, they can't tell a non-accelerating frame of reference. However, one of the symmetries that did break is the rotational frame of reference. So very early on, you got things symmetry breaking and things breaking off into basic symmetries, where you have the idea of rotation, and that rotation gives you links into spin up and spin down. So the fundamental particles, even though they melt, exist, they do exist, but even though they don't have a manifestation as a point or any particular they've got spatial properties, but not spatial properties which are definable. Okay, so let's say, look, an electron, you can grow quite a big electron. You can hold an electron in your hand. It's quite big, and this is one of the electrons on the Fermi surface of a metal. That's actually quite big. It's the size of your crystal, and that's one example of it. And then there's a I suppose if you freeze down something to a Bose-Einstein condensate, that actually gets big, and you can actually physically see it. Let's roll through this and see how much we can get. But this, as I said before, quantum mechanical things have no surfaces, and they have no, it exists there, but you can't actually put a marker on one part of the electron, because so electron's big, but you can't actually put a mark. You can't say, oh, that's one, it's, you can't actually pick one part of the electron. It's the whole thing. It's in your space, and it represents the sort of granularity, or the pixel size of your space. It's so, say you were actually stuck in a photograph, and you take it under a microscope, and the things are only that big. Well, you are the actual photograph. There's no reality beyond this photograph, so you can't actually if you exist completely with stuff within that photograph, you can't actually build anything in that photograph world which will allow you to see smaller than the actual pixel size which are built. That's probably about the best way I can describe it. So you get very early on in the universe, like incredibly soon, some of the symmetry is coming out, and so what happens is that we now have an absolute frame of reference of rotation. That is, if I spin, I can tell you how fast I'm spinning, full stop. I can't tell you how fast I'm moving relative to the universe. However, let's take a stop for a moment. We know how fast we're moving relative to the Big Bang, okay? And that's because when we photograph the Big Bang, the whole universe is Doppler shifted. So we can look back to an instant in time 385,000 years ago. So people say 400,000 years. I don't know. This is when you get the ionization and re-ionization events, whatever that goes. So when the thing is cooled down to 3,000 degrees, which is actually pretty cool. Okay, that's reddish glow. You know, the sun is 5,600 degrees. So 3,000 degrees is pretty cool, and at the moment it's cooled down a factor of 1,000 more. So it's only about 3 or 2.8 degrees Kelvin. We're talking about the Kelvin. The Kelvin there, but relative to that, we have a Doppler shift relative to the Big Bang. So we know how fast we're going relative to how fast we were when the first instance of time. That's an absolute thing we can pick out. And this is one of the things that is tooth-pulling. Can I say it's absolutely tooth-pulling? So what happens is you say, oh, here's an image. Okay, what does the black and blue mean? Oh, it means one part in 10,000. So that's not much. Oh, how is it processed? Oh, it's processed deep, beep, beep. So that's the first thing you read. And then you spend years and years of people doubting what ESA and YMAP and I forgot what the CMAP did. These are the different probes and the Planck's done. So there's a step that people gloss over. They gloss over removing the Doppler shift with respect to the start of the universe. So look, I'll get a little bit of, you know, this is sort of mind-bending, and it's a really bit confronting to read some people's versions of nuclear physics. Is just okay. We've got this microwave background, and really that tells us all. That's the only thing we can see, and the rest is guesswork on the back. Now people have this love affair with you can't start off with matter right away. Well, yeah, we're talking about like a fraction of a second. What happened to that fraction of a second? Was it light first and then turned into matter? People have got this real obsession with that happening. Now, how does light turn into matter? Well, I don't know. The closest I've look, all I can say is that the closest I've got is quantum string, or quantum loop. I've really forgotten. There's a person in South Australia who went to this lecture, and it was quite good. This is in terms of knots, topology of knots in space between the four banes. For each of your fundamental energies, you have a bane, a dimension. But we'll get into that. But imagine if I've got. Let's do the reverse. This is matter, antimatter, annihilation. So you've got a proton and an electron, and that will annihilate, which is allowed to do because your electron number is plus or minus one. Spins plus. Yeah, there's. You've got to have the spin up and spin down stuff. And look, can I just say, look, a anti-proton, sorry, an anti-electron, a positron, cannot annihilate itself in a proton. Okay, just get that into your head. So it can't, because what can happen? You're going to be left with a proton with an electronless mass. It's not allowed to do it. And it's got all these quantum numbers. Yeah, it's got the hadron number. This can't do it. It can only, a proton, so a positron, can only annihilate with an electron. You could say, well, it's a positive charge thing because it's repelled by the nucleus. I suppose you could say that. But it just can't happen. You've got to have a conservation law around it. But when they do come in, it unknots itself in the topologies come in. So the way that I could sort of imagine it, say if you've got those old serviette rings with some material, a big sheet with some material tucked through it, and some sort of knot which allows that serviette ring to move. But the actual serviette ring is not the actual particle. It's just, well, forget that. Well, imagine you have a sheet, you gather it up and you tie a knot to it. So what you've done is and your knot can go through different banes. So if it goes through the electromagnetic bane or the gravitational bane, it's all gone. But if the knot's the reverse way, spin, antimatter is going backwards in time and all the knotting is back. So you put the two together and it can just unknot and go back to the original ingredients, which is two light rays. And so when positron and electron come together, you get an annihilation, which is the reverse of matter creation. Okay, and two light rays are produced. Now you can time reverse that, and you're allowed to actually have two light rays coming in and create matter. And what it does, it creates equal amount of matter and antimatter. And we don't do that with light rays. I don't think I suppose you could do it with powerful enough lasers, but we do that at CERN. We just get two atoms and we smash them together, and there's so much energy there, we are creating, from energy, we're creating matter. You know, don't get angry at me. That's what happens. We've got a little bit of matter, and we put a huge amount of energy in it, and it's a relativistic frame, so its actual mass has increased. So it's still conservation of mass, and then that amount of matter gets converted into new matter, new particles are produced. But in general, they're crazy antiparticles. A lot of your, pion? Yeah. Or your mesons are a quark and an anti-quark pair. And they've got to be colour. Under quantum chromodynamics, they've got to be both green and anti-green, which is white, and that cancels everything out. So you can get all these mesons, and you can have them have different charges. So you can have an up and a down quark together, an up quark and an an up quark and an anti-down quark, and that gives you a meson with the charge plus one, or vice versa. It's like all those coming in. Let's have a general talk. So in that, it's almost meaningless to say, look, in this fraction billionth of a second, I know that it was all light first and then went matter. There's nothing like you have baryogenesis. So we don't know whether the radiation produced it, but how do we tell the amount of matter and dark matter and dark energy? From the that pattern from the Big Bang, that pattern that we see out there. We look at the angular frequency. So we take a Fourier transform of it, right? That's all we do, and we look at the number of frequencies. So you can make up anyway formed by different sine waves, and it's the high frequency space and the low frequency waveforms which come up there, and it's more or less random. You have the Fourier spectrum of white noise is still a spectrum, and so there are, it's made up of certain frequencies are abundant and they're not abundant, and there's harmonics, and the harmonics are used, and look, there's no way that I or any mortal, I think, can actually work out what those harmonics mean. But from those harmonics, so we have not detected any dark matter. We can sort of start to add up the dark matter, but we can see the amount of original dark matter here by looking at those oscillations in the Big Bang. And this is why Max Planck one is just such. This is the one that the Germans sent up. Really nice, really beautiful spacecraft they sent up, and we can see what's going on with that. And so that's told us that there's not these galactic superstrings. And I've gone to a few talks about this, people believing that there could still be galactic superstrings. This is before the data came in, out there in space. And so what is a string, and what does it weigh? Well, people are really skeptical of it. However, it's something that you really need to understand and believe in. It's like it's the strings, oh, not strings, but the things, space collapsing that way is something like the fundamental structure of matter is defined by it. So whether fundamentally this syllabus has said, look, I'm going to have to talk about some other ethical issues with the syllabus, but the syllabus has said with no sort of basis, no level of understanding, that first there was light, biblical light. There's so much light and energy there. So people can see there's so much energy that matter was created. Now, as you go through it, there's baryogenesis in the first fraction of the fraction. So in the tick, in that amount of time, all the matter, the mass of the universe is made, right? And we have this problem of asymmetry breaking, which means there's more matter than antimatter. At the moment, the best we can do is produce equal amounts. So there's something bigger there. Now, what I've just recently read is symmetry breaking of the neutral kaon, which is a meson, and I've just got to scratch my head and do it. But there's a whole series of new quantum mechanical things which I've just got to get my head around if I can have time. This is hypercharge and all the Higgs boson, the Higgs field, and we'll get into that for a short while. So that's a made, and then things are so hot and dense, they're too hot for nuclear fusion. Yep. So nuclear fusion has to wait till it cools down enough, and when it's cooled down enough, the hydrogen can fuse into helium, and more than half the hydrogen fuses into helium. So if we started off with 7 hydrogens, 4 fuse into helium in the first 12 minutes, and then few minutes after that. So this, now I've read one paper on this, and so I haven't been able to check. I've just read the time they had. So in the first minute, the length of this podcast, the matter was produced, and the temperature was still fiendishly hot, you know, millions of degrees, the inside of the sun, and the entire universe was a huge star, so to speak, with no, like, electrons have no surfaces, and there's actually no interesting thing. It's Yeah, can I say, I'm still getting my mind, I'm just getting on the back to the tenses, covariant and contravariant tenses, and having to read it. And unfortunately, I've lost my general relativity books to go around there. So within that very short time, and we know exactly what happened because you can follow it. And so at this point in time, 1 in 4 atoms in the universe is a helium. 3 is a hydrogen, and very little else has changed. There's like a fraction of a percent everything else, which is us. That's the major heat production source, and so there's a bit of a question there. At this stage, I just want to talk a little bit about the standard model, which is, you really have to talk about this if you're talking about the Big Bang. So in the standard model, you've got various things which have certain ranks. Okay, so there's the fundamental thing, which has got 0 rank, which is the Higgs scalar boson. That is, we are in a huge Higgs field, and the symmetry is broken, which I'm still trying to work out what that all means, but there's a top hat potential, and we are in the bottom of this top hat potential, and that gives everything mass, the Higgs potential. I could go on. So look, that's got a scalar. That's like a mass, a temperature, a pressure. Then we've got the next thing up, which is a spin half things. Now, I suppose they do have, I'm just trying to think where they have vector stuff. So in there, you've got 2 types of things, quarks and leptons. So in the leptons, they're the electric fields, and well, we know that everything's not perfect. You've got electrons and neutrinos, so they're both leptons. So if you produce an electron out of nowhere, you have to produce a similar antiparticle out of nowhere, which is a similar neutrino, if you're going to produce that. I think that's actually lost in the course. We no longer have that factor in the course. People have to realize that. So the electron feels charge, and neutrino doesn't feel any charge. It doesn't feel the strong force, doesn't feel charge, and I'm still trying to work it out. However, it does feel boson, the vector bosons, the W and Z vector boson. And look, to be quite honest, I cannot work out. I know that the W bosons carry charge and the Z boson doesn't carry charge, but as to what's inside these bosons, you know, search me. Okay, so there's that, and there's 3 generations of it, and I think that goes up to the SU, or their SU2 symmetry. They've got similar spin down, and I'm still scratching my head why there's only 3 generations of it. So you get the tau. So you've got the electron, and then the tau electron, and there's another electron after that, and they're muons, electrons, muon. Why do a muon is a type of a heavy electron, which is different from a meson. Then you've got quarks, and they're spin up, spin down, and top and bottom, and then charm and strange, I think. Might be. They're the 3 generations which get up there. And basically, the higher generations are unstable and decay. And you've got up and down quarks, and they're spin half again. And all these things have magnetic moments, but I'm pretty sure that a neutrino doesn't have a magnetic moment, but it might, you know. I don't know. I have to really think. I don't think it can have a magnetic moment now I think about it. Okay, so you've got those 4 by 3 or 12 12 particles, and the thing that I've read once, and I was a bit sick when I read it, so I just, it was almost a haze, that you've got charge and you've also got hypercharge, which are not unitary, but that the amount of hypercharge is how much it interacts with the Higgs field. And I'm just confused, because there's some electrons with no hypercharge, there's some electrons which don't have a mass. So that's, I've read it. I definitely read it. It's definitely there. It's just part of my brain where I haven't actually thought, oh, better resolve. I was picking up information. I just was saying, oh, well, you got no time to resolve it. That's all. That's it, kids. Let's go up. And so you got that. You got those. These are the particles. They're the stuff that makes up stuff. And look, if something's small, it's bigger in quantum mechanics. And so something small, something big, is sort of like foam. You know, foam is light, but it takes up space. And that's why everything has bulk. Because of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But just due to the nature of quantum mechanics and the particle size of space, the pixel size of space. So there's nothing funny about it. We're as big as and bulky as we are because of H is an interesting thing, which is Planck's constant. It's a unit of angular momentum. It's sort of the basic currency that the entire universe is used on. And it's, you know, why is it angular momentum? And it's sort of it's very interesting. It is an action, but it's also angular momentum, kilograms, meters squared. Kilograms, meters squared, seconds to the minus 2 or minus 1. It's a kgm, s to the minus 1 is a so I'll just work this out, so I'll get back to it. So H is a very fascinating thing, and why it is so. And it's really interesting that in that photons and things, they just trade H's. Like a photon, it does not have quantized energy. It has a quanta of energy. A photon transmits a quantum number of H, of plus and minus H. It's got a spin of one. So let's go through it. You've got your spin a half fermions. All of them are fermions. All of them spin a half is a fermion. Spin at plus or minus a half, and that means that they obey S2 symmetry, and it's beyond human imagination. Even though our entire world is made out of this stuff, we cannot imagine physically something which we rotate twice before we get back to look at it and what it means. And spin up and spin down, I probably had a image of it one time for what's going on. So let's go on to we've done the Higgs, we've done those little fermions, okay, and some of the properties of it is quite interesting. Makes up all matter, and I'll go back to how those quarks stick together, some of the mad nuclear physics that it's real amateurs put out there. So let's see. So the electromagnetic. So this gauge theory, which says that the symmetry of the force, and I've got the name. What's the name of that woman? It's gone from my head. Okay, so you've got the photon, which transfers force in the Fermi, in the Feynman diagrams between two charged particles. So that's the mediator of electromagnetic force. And I've just got to go with the electroweak theory. I have to go into it. and that's massless, so it can have an infinite distance. And then you have the gluon. The gluon actually interacts between two quarks, and what it does is it is a thing which actually changes two quarks. Now I have to really get in my head about it, but it too, just wait for it, a gluon does not have mass. A gluon is massless, right? So therefore it has to have a long range force. Just bear with me. There are things that have got mass, but gluons don't have a mass. So I don't think anyone's actually ever isolated a gluon. People have heaps of photons about. No one's isolated a gluon because gluons have... I suppose it must be string theory. Gluons operate on a different law of physics that you and I are not... Well, we are used to it because we're actually made out of particles held together by gluons, obviously, but we don't experience it out in our world. And look, I'm not absolutely sure. I really honestly can't remember where I read it. It's not the look, if I find out there's a gluon has a mass, I'll just rip my teeth out. The thing about a gluon is that it doesn't apply its force in our universe. Right. It applies its force, its interaction, through a flux tube, or its force is through a string, a line. And I don't have enough maths for it, and I've never had enough. And I haven't read any papers. How can I read papers on it? I'm out here. And the thing is that it's the force between quarks. Then again, look, you wouldn't. Like a lot of these things, people draw Feynman diagrams and then they think, oh, well, it has to be a spatial thing, and this is teeth reaching. But as you try and extend and break apart a proton, you take so much energy that the flux is so high it summons particles and antiparticles into space. So look, the fundamental thing is that a gluon's got no energy, and a gluon does not have an energy space that we can fully understand. So your two particles, the actual force is concentrated directly between the two, so gravity extends in all directions, but a gluon extends in the two. And who knows what the maths is? It's obviously that it does happen. So you can't actually pull a proton apart, because in pulling the energy required to pull it apart produces antiparticles in it. And again, look, we're left struggling to understand this sort of thing. Now, it is true. So the Saxon Woods potential is sort of my choice potential. It's a 1956 potential. I myself find, because that's something which is a quantum mechanical potential, and you can actually put quantum mechanical energies into it and get things like metastable atoms. So cobalt metastable is forbidden to decay in energy, and so this symmetry, perfect symmetry, which says that if you put neutrons into cobalt, you can make it, I think it's cobalt 60. Again, that's just a lot on my brain. It's just the number floating into my head. That's a two photon, is it spin electrical quadrupole radiation. So it would be interesting what the gamma rays out of that. But so you've got two equal energy gamma rays, two photon emission. That's why cobalt's got such a long lifetime. So normally, if something's in a gamma ray state, it doesn't last that long. I just have to think, because there are some long life gamma ray sources, which I've experienced on the Mossbauer effect. So you can get the actual width of the gamma ray line by its lifetime. So if it's got a long lifetime, it can have a very short, very sharp peak. But if it's a quick... So you can actually tell the lifetime of your gamma ray source from the thickness of the source. But that being said, you just can't get any of the quantum mechanical symmetries and the stuff that you get, the spin up, spin down, all that thing happening, if your a little proton is actually, or neutron, is sitting in the Bohr liquid drop model. They have to actually exist through them through themselves. And people are so addicted to a spatial model that the actual neutrons and protons can't actually just float through themselves because they've got different quantum numbers. Right, this is now it is a complex thing, within a proton, is held together by the strong nuclear force because it's between quarks and that's gluons. Now, people say, look, an atom is held together by mesons. It's mesons. A meson is a quark, anti-quark thing which is momentarily produced. Look, that may be true, and I have the luxury of not understanding it and not getting it for certain reasons. And so that's not because I'm stupid, but because it violates, for me, certain laws. So I can see how a group of three quarks of a particular, in a particular state, similar to the way electrons glide through each other. So there's insight, quantum mechanical insights into how an atom is made is go into a nucleus. So that's your gluon, no mass, and it has a force. Why it's short range is not because it's massive. I don't know why. You can sort of see why if things are massive, it gets a lot of energy and it actually just fall apart. So you've got your photons in your spin one vector bosons. You're okay. Light's definitely a vector. Gluon's a vector, but it's sort of like super weird. I can't get my head around it. And then even so, you've got your W and Z bosons, which are completely different. One carries charge, so that's how your proton turns into a neutron and the charge goes with it. So for beta decay, you need your W plus and W minus vector bosons. So that's counted as one force boson, and then you've got Z, your Z boson, Z naught boson, which carries no charge whatsoever. So that's effectively, if you've got an electron which can interact with those electroweak bosons, the electron will just suddenly, for no reason, bounce off if it's hit by Z naught bosons. But we actually don't know what's... Well, I've got no... You get a feeling that there's something inside them because the bosons can decay to other particles. The massive bosons can decay into other particles, whereas gluons can't and photons can't decay, thank goodness. But both of them are excitations of a field, and which really get back to it, like you can really get a sense of it. Like if light is an excitation of the electromagnetic bane, so too are these localized things, which are localized. Like an electron is a localized excitation, but you can put an electron on top of another because they're just field excitation. So that's why electrons, if they haven't got the same quantum number, spin through. Now, it's hard to say. I was going to. Oh, it sounds a bit gruesome. I was about to cark it a while ago, and so I sort of had a philosophical view about. Oh well, I've seen some amazing stuff. I've probably understood a few stuff. I wish I had more people to chat with and describe. And so this is a long talk coming up. Up from just there. The next one, we're going to go back and look at the Doppler shift. What's his name? Oh, it's really gone. There you go, my head. This is about the redshift, the expansion of the universe, Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Who's the person? There's a person. I've forgot this piece of paper. I'm walking in the dark at the moment. The light's coming up. The name of the person. That's the next section we're going to go on. So, look. In general, it's coming back to that very first point. I hope we've gone through some of the particles and the fact. Oh, the fact is that the Big Bang microwave background doesn't show there's any strings out there in space. Still, maybe, I'm sure there's people who still believe it. This is the discovery of Hubble. Yeah, the Hubble space. I don't know how I can get that one there. This is coming through. There's this religious belief that in the beginning there was light. Well, in the beginning there was light, energy, matter, and dark matter and dark energy. Those things which we have no models to describe what's going on, and it's teaching people, getting people to say, look, first there was light, and then it got converted into matter. But that all happened within a fraction of a second, and at a time where the laws of physics and existence were just coming into being. Have they learned all that much more? Do they understand it all that much more? What is the benefit of saying it? So for me, it's such a complex, and it's a beautiful thing to go through, I suppose what I find fascinating is that people are looking for these macroscopic strings, yet you've got these really non-physics concepts. You know, surely a gluon is something really fascinating to look at. The fact that it's got no mass and a short range, but due to its geometry, surely that's an interesting thing to go on. Where you actually miss out on talking about these big features in that big talk there. So that's Pinnacle Explains. I hope it's of someone just talking there. And look, hopefully in a few weeks' time, I'll study some more maths. You never know, it might all come up to me. And hopefully people have made some huge discoveries. I do remember going to a lecture of this lady, this woman who explained all the banes. It was a popular science lecture, but she was working in the US about the different banes and why. This is membranes, multidimensional surfaces, and look, essentially if something has to interfere, it has to be in the medium of it all. So she described the four different bands. I'll have to go back and actually clue myself into a bit of this string theory for gluons. Again, look, these are things, I think people should be honest in terms of they don't have, you know, we don't have these answers for you. We can tell you what an electron is because we can show you one. We can tell you what a proton and a neutron is because we can give it to you. But it's something that is going to be outside our experience. These Z naught vector bosons of the electro weak force. And yeah, I'll have a look at that overall. I suppose it's called the unification of the different theories. So I'll have to read into that. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll keep on rehabilitating with time.